Well, when one is a guest speaker, one is put in a rather awkward position because I haven't met most of you people before. And when you contemplate, what in the world am I going to preach on? You don't know whether what you might choose would be really relevant to people or helpful to them. And so what I thought I would do this morning is start with a little Bible test. I'll give you some test questions. This requires a little audience participation. And based upon how intelligent I think you are, I'm going to pick what lesson I'm going to preach this morning. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to make a statement that's not true. And if you realize it's not true, you might yell out the name of the person that disproves it. For example, I might say, nobody was ever put in a fiery furnace and survived. And you'd say, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? How about nobody ever went up to heaven in a fiery chariot?
Elijah.
Elijah, yeah. Nobody was ever thrown in the lion's den and survived.
Daniel.
Nobody was ever asked to offer their son in sacrifice by God.
Abraham.
Okay. Well, it seemed like you're a pretty sharp crowd. All right. Now, having selected the sermon of the morning, seriously, I have heard of the faith of this congregation many places that I have gone, and I have looked forward to coming here and being with you today, and I was just pleased to no end that I was given the opportunity to speak with you and share some things with you. I'm particularly pleased. I found out just this morning, David happened to ask Sister Hayes, well, who is your preacher now? And she said, well, Mike Bozeman. I knew Mike back in Indiana for 20 years. I preached there in central Indiana, and I got to know Mike and his wife. And in fact, I don't know if they remember this, but we played the newlywed game at the Schultz's house, and all of us were married 10 years or better, except for one newlywed couple, and it was them. And I don't know what they may have thought of us old married people, but down through the years we have thought fondly of them. I think you are rather fortunate to have him working with you here, and if his Bible class this morning is any indication of the work that he is doing with you, I think you are well served in that. It's great to see all the young ones here. I have five of mine that are still at home, and when I go on trips like this, I miss them dearly. In fact, my little one's birthday is tomorrow, and I'm going to have to miss that. So I have a soft spot in my heart for that, and it bodes well for the future of God's people, I hope, that we see so many young people. If you will, turn to John chapter 1. This is where we want to begin this morning. I joke, we might as well begin in the beginning, but that's how John begins. In the beginning. And of course, when he does that, you automatically think back to the creation story. But what's peculiar about John is how he begins this book by saying, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. And all things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Why in the world does John call Jesus, obviously we'll learn a little bit later that he's obviously talking about Jesus, why call him the Word? Are we supposed to go to the dictionary and just flop it open and point to a word and say, well, that's the word Jesus is, corporation, that's the word. Well, of course, it's not a particular word, it is really a message that he's talking about. But why refer to Jesus as a message? Well, it becomes clear as he begins unfolding this chapter, he's talking about a revelation that God makes to mankind. And of course, the importance of that is that if we are to come to know God, it will only be because God reveals himself to us, that God discloses himself to us. We cannot go and sit under a coconut tree somewhere and just think and think all day long and somehow come to know God. God must reveal himself to us. And how has God done that? Well, God has done that in many ways. Obviously, Hebrews chapter 1 is very similar to the beginning of John chapter 1 and the point that they make, that in lots of different ways, God has revealed himself through the prophets, but has in these last days revealed himself to us through his Son, who is not just a son or somebody, but it is none other than the express representation of God himself and the radiance of his glory. And this is what John is getting at here. Jesus is not the only revelation that God has ever given to us, but He is certainly the supreme revelation. He is the fullest revelation. This is as much as it is going to get until God finally and fully discloses Himself in whatever way that He will in the final day of judgment. That certainly we will come to know God in a more intimate and a more full way then, but in the time that we have on this earth, in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son. And so coming down to verse 14, this highlights the importance of what John goes on to say in these verses. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we beheld His glory. Glory as of an only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John, that is John the Baptist, bore witness of Him and cried out, saying, "This was He of whom I said, He who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for He existed before me. For of His fullness we have all received, and grace instead of grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth are realized through Jesus Christ." Oh, I just came up with another test question for you. Nobody in the Old Testament ever got to see God. Moses. Verse 18. Nobody has seen God at any time. The only God in the bosom of the Father, He has explained Him or revealed Him. You see, the moment John says, nobody has seen God at any time, your brain can't help but go back and say, well, wait a minute, what about Moses? What about Moses? And I know that's a weird story. I can't tell you exactly what happened there. But it appears to me that from what John affirms is that nobody really has ever seen God in some kind of direct physical fashion. And in addition to Moses, there are a couple of other occurrences that might fall in that same category. But again, it seems to me John intends for us to leap back to that story that we know about from the Old Testament. Now, we may not know where it's from, but it turns out it's from Exodus chapter 33 and 34. So we want to do three things this morning. First of all, we want to look at this background of Exodus chapter 33 and 34. We want to come back and see how John 1 fits into all of this. And then finally, what does that mean for me today? So back here in Exodus chapter 33, I want you to notice, first of all, beginning in verse 7, Moses used to take the tabernacle and pitch it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp, and he called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came about that everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp, and it came about whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle that all the people would arise and stand each at the entrance of his tent and gaze after Moses until he entered the tabernacle. And it came about whenever Moses entered the tabernacle, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tabernacle, and the Lord would speak with Moses. Why did they call it the Tabernacle of Meeting? Well, that's because God met with Moses there. And what God met with Moses for wasn't to get together and play checkers or something. God was revealing Himself to Moses at this special tent or tabernacle where God would reveal Himself to him. Now, this is not the tabernacle because that hasn't been built yet. But when the tabernacle is built later on, it appears that that then becomes the replacement for the old Tabernacle of Meeting, and it will then become the place where God will reveal Himself to Moses. But the point of all this is that there was this special tabernacle where God revealed Himself to Moses. And you remember when we read from John chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh, and I know most Bibles say dwelt among us, but in fact, John does not use the ordinary word for dwelling there. He uses the term tabernacle, that He tabernacled among us. Some of you will have a footnote to show you that. And why does He do that? Well, now here's a second element that he puts into his text here that causes us to immediately connect Moses and Jesus. And of course, we've already seen in John chapter 1, he explicitly connects Moses and Jesus. The law came through Moses. The grace and truth are realized through Jesus Christ. He is clearly making a contrast and comparison between Moses and Jesus. Well, the comparison grows even more because finally, when we get down to the actual unfolding of this peculiar story where Moses sees God, you have to go back and realize a little what's going on here. We've had the sin with the golden calf in chapter 32, and Moses is going to try to stick it out with these people, and he realizes that the Lord has been patient with them, and Moses is looking for some kind of assurance from the Lord that he's going to stick with Moses. And the Lord is going to give him such a sign. And so in verse 17, the Lord says to Moses, I will also do this thing of which you have spoken, for you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. But then notice in verse 18 what Moses asks. And then Moses said, I pray you, show me your glory. I want to see your glory. Now, what do you suppose Moses was asking for? Well, it seems apparent, especially in the Lord's answer to him, that he was looking for some kind of physical representation or manifestation of God to him, and that if he could see that, that that would just really bolster Moses' faith. I want to see God, we might paraphrase it. But you'll notice he actually asked, I want to see your glory. But now notice the Lord's answer in verse 19. He said, I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But you can't see my face. No one can do that and live. And God makes this arrangement to hide him, and he sees the back side of God and so on. Again, I don't know what all that means. But it seems pretty clear that John says, whatever happened here, nobody ever really saw God that way, in some kind of physical direct sense. And so God makes an accommodation to Moses. It seems to me that God is saying to Moses, now I know what you're asking for, and I'm going to accommodate you as I can. But verse 19 seems a very odd answer to the request to see God's glory. God doesn't say yes or no. God doesn't immediately say, well, you can't see my glory. You can't see my face and live. We're going to have to do it this other way. What he says is, I will make my goodness pass before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will be compassionate to whom I will be compassionate. And that just seems to me an awful odd answer to Moses' question, unless it has some bearing on what Moses really was asking. So in other words, it seems to me that God is saying to Moses, in essence, now Moses, when you ask to see my glory, I know what you mean by that. I know what you think my glory is, but you need to understand my real glory is that I am gracious to whom I am gracious, and I am compassionate to whom I am compassionate to. And in fact, when he passes before Moses, and the event takes place now in chapter 34, as he said, he would proclaim the name of the Lord before him. And what is that name? Verse 6 of Exodus chapter 34. The Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. And yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. There is the justice side of God that has to be reckoned with. But fortunately, that comes in the context of the fact that God is a compassionate God. And so the whole story then becomes a story about God's character, that he is a God of compassion, that he is a God of grace, that he is a God of extraordinary patience. That's my glory. Now, there are a lot of ways in which the glory of God is manifest. We're not here to say that the word glory only is used in this sense. I mean, the physical manifestations of God are his glory. The praise of God is called his glory. His great wisdom is his glory. His great power is his glory. But there is a glory that far outshines all of these. And that's the focus of John again. When we go back to John chapter 1, this is the very point that John's trying to get across to us. The message of God, the revelation of God, has been disclosed to us through Jesus Christ. Yes, God revealed Himself through Moses at the tabernacle. But what was revealed through Moses was just a partial bit of God's purpose. It was an incomplete understanding. What we have now received in Jesus is the full revelation of who God is. And if even in Moses' day, God revealed Himself to be a God of compassion and grace, how much more so that is true, how much more fully that is seen in Jesus Christ. And so the Word became flesh. The message of God, the revelation of God became in a fleshly, physical form and tabernacled among us. It became the new tabernacle, a new place of revelation of God for us. And so, yes, no man has seen God at any time, but He's now been revealed, explained through this Jesus. And so John is able to say, we beheld His glory. They didn't have to ask for it like Moses did. And the glory they saw was not the same as what accommodation that God made for Moses back in Exodus chapter 33 and 34. This is the true glory of God that they saw in Jesus Christ. Abounding in loving kindness and truth. Full of grace and truth. That is the real glory of God. Now, where did John see that? Was that when Jesus worked one of His miracles, walking on the water, feeding the 5,000? Was it in the great teaching that Jesus did? Well, it's pretty obvious as we read through the Gospel of John that what John thinks of most of all when he talks about the glorification of the Son, it is His crucifixion. When he talks about the lifting up of the Son of Man, when he talks about the time it would come for Him to be glorified, it is ironic. Because obviously as the world looks at the crucifixion, that's a very inglorious thing. But John came to understand it was the most glorious thing of all. And that's why Paul says pretty much the same thing at the beginning of the Corinthian letter. And this is the scripture reading that we have this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. In verse 17, Paul says he didn't come to preach the gospel in cleverness of speech, that the word of the cross would be emptied of its power. And he goes on to describe the message of the cross is foolishness, or what we might more precisely refer to as madness. That's Paul's idea here. It's just absolutely crazy. This idea that God Himself comes down in human form and dies on a cross? Are you crazy? What kind of idiot God does that? When you think of God in terms of power, when you think of God in terms of prestige and authority, what God would do that? And that's exactly Paul's point. What God would do that? But a God of compassion, a God of grace, a God that is slow to anger, a God that is abounding in loving kindness and faithfulness. And that's why John and the others were able to say, when we looked at the cross of Jesus Christ, we saw the glory of God. That God is a merciful God and compassionate. Now the world looks at that kind of God and says, well, a God you can kill, what good is that? A God that is weak, what good is that? But Paul said in chapter 2, verse 2, that he would preach nothing but a crucified Christ. That properly understood that everything you need to know about being a child of God is packed into that truth that Jesus is a crucified Christ. What does that tell you? Well, there's a lot of things that we could unpack about that, but one thing certainly that must be impressed upon you is that every second that Jesus stays upon that cross, that is a testimony to the power of His love What power in this world could keep Jesus nailed to a piece of wood? No external power, no physical power. Nothing could compel him to do that except the fact that he loved the people that he was doing it for. The irony of it all is that he is the fellow who made the wood that he stuck to. He made the iron ore that the people fashioned into the nails that nailed him to that cross, and he made the very people who put him on that cross as their creator. But not any of those things could keep him there. Only his love, that he did that out of compassion. You know, I think about all that Jesus went through, and certainly the crucifixion must have been excruciatingly painful. But I know my buttons are so easily pushed. You know, if I'm up on a cross and somebody comes by and says, "You stand up because you can't save yourself," I want to bet. "Come down off that cross and then we'll believe." I come flying off there so fast and incinerate everybody, and there, I'll show you, didn't I? It'd be a big empty room, an empty planet. "Oh, I'm powerful. Look what I did." But the greater power is to stay on that cross and die for the very people hurling those insults in your teeth. And that is an extraordinary power. The power to zap people, the power to make the earth shake, so what? The power to sacrifice oneself for their own good, even though they don't want it. And they don't know it. That's how compassionate and gracious God. John says, we saw that kind of glory in Jesus Christ. What a marvelous glory it is. But again, what a message of madness to the world. Paul says, I would know nothing but a crucified Christ. But you know, the message of the cross that Paul refers to in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 isn't that Jesus just, or Paul went around talking about Jesus saying, a man named Jesus died on a cross. Isn't that something? The message itself is the meaning of such an event. There have been a lot of people, probably a lot of people named Jesus or Joshua, who were crucified. So what? There's nothing particularly significant in those crucifixions. There was nothing particularly significant if you had been there at Gethsemane and saw the criminal on the right or the left. You know, Jesus' cross wasn't any bigger. It didn't glow any brighter. There wasn't anything physical about it that would attract any attention to the middle cross. It is only with the eye of faith that we see that something extraordinary was happening in that middle cross. That here is the Creator giving Himself, sacrificing Himself for His own creation. And so when Paul speaks of the message of the cross, he's talking about, yes, the fact that Jesus died on the cross, but what's the significance of that? What's the whole meaning of that? What does that say to you about the character of God? That He is a loving God, He is a compassionate God, He's a gracious God. But it cuts even deeper than that. Because we have to come to the point where we understand, what does this have to do with me? And the sooner we realize that every single time we learn something about God, we learn something about ourselves. You can't help it. That's the very nature of what it is to know God as God. To avoid the fundamental sin that Paul mentions in Romans chapter 1 and verse 21, that although we know God, we refuse to honor Him as God or give thanks. If we learn that God is holy, that automatically tells me, without another word, I need to be holy. If I find out that God is righteous, I must be righteous. If I find out that God speaks the truth, I must speak the truth. Everything I learn about God, I need, therefore, to understand something about myself. And that makes all the difference in how we understand this message of God's grace. Because, frankly, I sometimes get pretty sick of talking about love. God is love. You know, John said that twice in 1 John chapter 4. It's kind of like in the Harry Potter books. You know, the answer is always no. And preachers are always talking about love. And it comes across as some kind of syrupy sentimentality. Not the love of which the Bible speaks. The grace of God becomes nothing more than a license for us to go out and live as we please. We just take it for granted. God's just some old grandpa sitting on the porch, and yeah, he told us all these things we shouldn't do, but he didn't really mean it. And so we can go, you know, climb the trees or run in the street or whatever, and oh, grandpa's going to let us get by with it because he just loves us so much. And that is not the message of the cross. Sometimes we will hear people call for more hard preaching. And I know what kind of hard preaching most of them want. Get up in the pulpit, call people by name, point the finger at them, indict them of all kind of terrible things they're doing. You know, that's not hard preaching, at least not for me. Given my own native instincts, I'd love to do that. I'd love nothing more to get up here and tell you who all's wrong and why all they're doing wrong and making judgments about them. That's easy preaching. I tell you what hard preaching is. If you have any clue at all about what the grace of God means, about what the cross of Jesus Christ means, what the message of a crucified Christ is, how in the world can you stand up here and preach on the grace of God? Knowing that the very moment that you're standing there, the very moment that you're preaching, you are the biggest sinner in the world. That if this is who God really is, does it not call, does it not well up from our very gut a sense of shame and humiliation and disgust that we don't serve God as He is deserving? How can anyone with any sense of conscience and a desire to be free of hypocrisy feel like they can, with any adequacy, describe the grace of God Almighty? But it is a reality that that's what a lot of us do with God's grace. We use it as a license, a get-out-of-jail-free card. This entitles me now to go out and live my life in a self-indulgent way as I want to. And it is a fact of life that the vast majority of the religious world interprets the grace of God that way. I acknowledge that. But that is not the right response to the grace of God. The only response to the grace of God is to get an overwhelming sense of gratitude, of absolute unworthiness. But instead of throwing up our hands and quitting, we are determined that I'm going to do the best I can to show Him that I love Him for what He's done for me. And I'm going to try to help Him and His cause and be like Him, even though I might fall short of that. But I can't do anything else. If I really understand the message of the cross, how can one stand there at Gethsemane and look at the bruised and beaten, bleeding body of Jesus and say, look at that, I get to live as I want to now. I'm free of any of the consequences of my sin. If you look at the cross of Jesus Christ, what you see is the greatest obligation that you will ever confront in your life. That's a man I need to be like. And I will spend the rest of my life falling short of being like Jesus perfectly. But I cannot grow weary in my determination to be like Him and to follow Him. Now we mentioned 1 John chapter 4. We will turn there. We will finish our lesson there this morning. Because it is extraordinary that John doesn't only say that no man has seen God at any time in his gospel. He wrote that again another time in 1 John chapter 4. In the very same chapter where he is trying to impress upon us the love of God, that if he boils down the very character and nature of God, he uses the word love to describe it. And that is the message of God's character. That is the message of the crucified Christ. When you properly understand what love is, not this syrupy sentimentality, but a love that would sacrifice oneself and one's good for the good of others. A life that is lived so selflessly, so sacrificially, so sufferingly, so surrenderingly. That is the life of Jesus. That is the love of Jesus. You know, I suppose everybody in the world believes love's a good thing. I suppose if we had circulated a survey before the assembly and said, do you think love's a good thing or a bad thing? Do you think it's something Christians ought to do or not? We'd all say yes. And if that's all we get out of it, so what? What did we learn? Our problem is not that we know that we need to love. It is that we need to love as God has loved. To love as Jesus loves. To be compassionate as Jesus is compassionate. Paul says in Colossians chapter 3 that we are to forgive one another Whoever has a complaint against anyone, it doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. Let's be forbearing with one another and forgiving of one another. Just as the Lord has forgiven you, so also should you. It's not that we ought to be forgiving. It's not that we ought to be loving. The problem is I need to love as Jesus loved. I need to forgive according to the standard of Jesus. And that's what causes us trouble. How can I learn to love others? How can I learn to forgive others? How can I learn to live a life of service for others, even those who don't deserve it? How can I learn to serve to the point of sacrifice? How can I learn to sacrifice to the point of suffering? How can I learn to suffer to the point of even full surrender, if need be, for the good of others? In 1 John chapter 4, verse 7, John says, "Beloved, let us love one another. For love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. By this, the love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent His only Son into the world, so that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sin. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and His love is perfected in us. And by this we know that we abide in Him, and He in us, because He has given us of His Spirit. And we have beheld and bear witness that the Father has sent the Son to be the Savior of the world." In the Gospel, John wanted to make the point, no one has seen God at any time. No one has seen God in some kind of physical manifestation directly. But we have seen God in Jesus. We have seen the character of God, especially that character of His love and His mercy in Jesus. But now John has brought it up here in his epistle to make the point, yeah, no one's seen God again, but if He's seen in us, if the character of God is alive within us, if I am compassionate, if I am gracious, if I am slow to anger, if I am full of grace and truth, if I can forgive others that don't deserve it as Jesus did, then people will see God. People will see the character of God living in me. If you will, take your songbook and turn to the song that has been selected, number 319, Only a Step. In 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter talks about being a partaker or sharer in the divine nature. And that's what we're talking about this morning, to know what God's character is, and to see that as a pattern, as a requirement of what my character ought to be. And of course, we live in this world in which we're veiled, the flesh that we live in, the material world that surrounds us, veils us to seeing God directly, and so we must see by the eye of faith. And we must see the character of God revealed in Jesus Christ. We must see it alive in the character of fellow Christians. We hope to see it alive in our own life. But we have this great hope that John speaks of in 1 John chapter 3. See how great a love with which the Father has loved us. You know, John does that quite a bit. John 3:16, God so loved the world. It's not that God chose a special word that describes His love. It's not that there's some special definition of love. When John tries to define the love of God, he says, let me see, how can I explain it to you? Look at the fact that God sent His Son to die for you. That tells you something about the kind of love that God has. And now he says in 1 John 3, see the great love of which the Father has loved us, that we should be called the children of God, and such we are. He goes on to explain, that's why the world doesn't understand us, because it doesn't understand God. And the implication is that we look like God. We're like God. Just like red-headed parents tend to have red-headed children. You know, if God is of this character, we ought to be of this character. Be like God. And if the world doesn't understand God, it will not understand us. It will see our message as a message of madness. But he goes on to say, that it has not yet appeared what we shall be. We know that when he appears, we will see him as he is, because we will be like him. To describe our relationship with God as that of parent and child, father and son, is a very intimate and powerful figure. And you think of the love that any normal parent would have for their children, the sacrifices that they make on their behalf. But John says a time will come where that will not even suffice. The relationship that we will have with God will be beyond description. And all I can say is we will see him as he is, because we will be like him. See this glory of God. See the mighty character of God and who he is. He has done it all. And all that can be required of us is to come and take that one step of humbling ourselves before him and saying, Lord, I am so unworthy when I see your grace. But it powerfully compels us. I want to be like you. And I want to please you. And I no longer want to do what I want to do. But I want to do what you would have me to do. If you know that determination and that decision, and you know what you need to do to make your life what it ought to be. As John goes on to say in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3, that all who have this hope purify themselves even as he is pure. And that's the determination we need to make every day. If there's some way we can help you in that this morning, of making your life more pure, helping you in obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, whatever your need might be this morning, let it be known while we stand and while we sing the song of invitation.